I can't imagine what they're going through, because after those storms, when we went outside, it had looked like a bomb went off. Like, literally, it was like the apocalypse. It's like just wasteland. It's all brown outside, right? So the flies are feeding these dead animals. It's hell. That's all I can express. It's hell.
More on how islands recover or don't from devastating storms like Hurricane Dorian later in the show. First, though, we're going to remember some of the victims of Monday's tragic diving boat fire in the Channel Islands. The bodies of 33 of the 34 presumed dead have been recovered. Authorities haven't yet released information about the victims, but some of their friends and family members have taken to social media to mourn the loss of their loved ones. Brett Harmeling remembered his sister, Christy Finstad, in a Facebook post. Christy was a marine biologist who was leading the scuba diving trip on the boat. She owned Worldwide Diving Adventures with her husband, Dan. Scott Chan was on the boat with his daughter. He was a physics teacher at American High School in Fremont. That's in Northern California. The Fremont Unified School District said in a statement about him that his students knew him to be an innovative and inspiring teacher who developed a passion for physics among his students. A scuba-certified family of five from Stockton was also on board. The husband and wife, both nurses, and they were celebrating his birthday. Two of the victims lived in the same condo complex here in Santa Monica. Neighbors Mary Beth Guiney and Charles McIlvain went diving together often, along with McIlvain's wife, who was in Miami at the time. Guiney was a sales director and ocean wildlife enthusiast, and I spoke with her friend Katie Spicer about Mary Beth Guiney earlier. I'm really sorry for your loss. It must be completely unreal for you still. How are you feeling about it?
Overwhelmed. It's so very tragic what happened to all of those people, and especially my friend. And I've never had anything in my life happen like this, to lose someone so tragically and horrifically like this.
Yeah. Well, tell us more about Mary Beth and how you met her, how you knew her.
I've known Mary Beth 10-15 years now. We were work acquaintances and just immediately created a bond together and started hanging out outside of the office and going to events, concerts, shows, games. She was just an amazing human being and had so much life. And it's going to be hard realizing I can't just pick up the phone and call her and say, let's go grab a bite to eat or a drink. It's not real yet to me. And talking about her in the past tense feels wrong.
Yeah. Well, what had she told you about this trip?
She goes on dive trips pretty frequently, all over the world, frankly, and has done this dive before, as well as Catalina dives. And it was just something that she was planning to do. We wanted to get together actually this weekend. She said, no, I've had this trip planned for a few months, and she was really excited about it.
Gosh, that is so tragic. And it just seems so cruel and so random that this happened.
Completely.
And so she was, I looked at her Facebook page, and it's her profile picture is her kissing a dolphin. The dolphin is right up.
Yeah, that's pretty much Mary Beth.
So it's a beautiful picture. So she was a lover, obviously, of the outdoors and of the water and of the animals, too. She had a lot of, I guess, fundraising appeals for animals, endangered animals on her page.
Yes, she was heavily involved with ocean life and conservation of the animals and making sure that they were protected and cared for. And she loved the water, loved the water. Every time I talked to her, she was off to some exotic land to go scuba diving and some odd new adventure that like would scare me, but she was all in for.
Yeah. Wow. So she sounded like she really attacked life.
Lived it to the fullest.
Had a really
more
really,
than anyone I probably ever met.
Wow. And had such a great life.
Amazing.
How old was she?
Too short. I believe 50. Uh-huh.
Had just turned 50. So you two would go out to games. I understand she was a big football fan. You're a football fan?
Yes. We both are football fans. Both of our teams, well, her team is a little bit stronger as they're the Patriots, and I'm a Seahawks fan, and they met in the Super Bowl a few years back, and she had a field day when the Patriots won. So, yeah, she's a huge football fan, loved her Boston teams as well.
And she had family from New England? She's from New England?
Yeah, she's from that area. I believe she also had some family over in Ireland as well, but she moved out west. Her career took her out here, and she just loved the life and the climate and everything that Los Angeles had to offer, and grew roots here.
Yeah. And so at work, I guess all of you are in a state of shock and mourning.
Yeah, all of my friends have our monthly, quarterly dinners and nights out, and it just doesn't feel real. I texted her, and I know I'm never going to hear from her again, but it doesn't feel real. It feels so foreign to me right now.
Yeah. Well, I am very, very sorry for your loss, and I appreciate you spending the time remembering your friend Mary Beth Guiney with us today.
Thank you very much. She's a wonderful human being. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And now let's remember Mary Beth Guiney's diving friend, Charles McIlvaine. He was 34 years old and worked as a visual effects designer for Walt Disney Imagineering. And joining us now to remember him is Joan Bryant. She has known Charles ever since he was a child growing up in Woodland Hills. Welcome to you, Joan.
Thank you.
How do you remember him as a child? What was he like when he was young?
Really outdoors kid. He and his brother were just outdoors all the time, just riding bikes and getting into trouble. There were other neighborhood boys that they hung with, and my girls were a little older than them, but they were just climbing trees and, you know, being loud. But even as a kid, he had that big smile and that funny class clown way.
Yeah. Yeah. People on social media are remembering he was like the life of the party. Like, he was always happy morning, noon, and night.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You always were lifted up when you left him. And I think even at parties and at events where I would see him at his mother's home, she was my longtime dear friend, Suzanne Adams. He would be wherever he was sitting. That's where you wanted to be, around him, to hear his stories and his regaling and his laughter. And he was just so fun and upbeat. It was always great to be around him.
Mm. And so he was married, as we mentioned earlier. His wife also would go on dives with him.
Yes, she's Australian, and they go every year to Australia and dive, and they dived in Bora Bora and off the California coast, of course, but just they did that together. They were passionate about it and loved everything aquatic and water, and diving was just their passion. And so, she was not on the boat with him. She was working on a film in Miami, thinking that she needed to hurry up and finish there to get out of the way of the hurricane, and then got the news that she had to fly back to L.A. I'm sure she probably thought Dorian was the tragedy she was going to be experiencing, not this.
Yeah. And so, you must be in shock as well, since you knew him as a little boy. And
yeah, it's horrible. His mother is so close to me, and we have in this group of mothers whose kids grew up in the neighborhood in Woodland Hills, we have stayed together, very bonded and close throughout all these years. And we all have sons, and it's like you feel it like it's your son. You know, it's just, it's a horror.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I'm very, very sorry for your loss.
Yes. He was a megawatt guy. Big. He lived out loud, and he was just bigger than life, and I'll just always see him with his big smiling face and his great attitude. Just never forget that.
Joan Bryant, remembering Charles McIlvaine, one of the people who died in that boat fire on Monday. Another admissions scandal story involving USC today. A bunch of emails between the university's athletics department and admissions office were made public this week. They show the school had detailed lists of so-called special interest applicants. with wealthy parents who'd either made big donations to the school or could potentially make one. The emails came out in the case of a Miami financier who's one of dozens of parents accused of cheating their kids' way into USC and other top schools. The man's lawyer is now subpoenaing USC for more information on these flagged students and what their families donated. USC is fighting that, but the school's system raises questions about how top colleges and universities consider wealth in their admissions process. Here to talk about all this is Melissa Korn, higher education reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about what was in these emails. What did they say?
Sure. So there's a set of 18 records, email exchanges, including databases and spreadsheets, I should say, that certain people would send to the admissions office, essentially with their wish lists of, here's the people I would like to see get in, with details of who they are, what sport they played, if they played a sport, who their connection was to the school, whether it was former athletic director Pat Hayden or lots of others, various athletic administrators, coaches, development officers, and then details about, frankly, why they're such attractive candidates, dollar figures, potential donor, father is surgeon, car dealer, things like that.
And who is sending the emails to whom?
Sure. So in some cases, these lists were coming from the athletic director for development and going to Donna Heinel, a senior athletic administrator, and then she would then share them with the admissions office. In some cases, it was the admissions office sending them back and listing what the outcome was for the various candidates, if they were admitted for fall or spring or denied, things like that.
And were all of the candidates who were flagged as potentially good prospects, were they all admitted?
No, they were not. There were plenty of cases where they were not admitted, and there can be a variety of reasons for that. And I think one of the things USC has said in response to these emails coming out is that they're proof that the athletic department does not get a rubber stamp in dictating who gets into the school.
But the other question
it
raises...
it's not a sure thing that just because you're flagged.
Yeah. But the other thing it raises is, what kind of influence did the money part play in this? When they said, oh, these parents could possibly donate in the future, what did that play in the decision to admit or not?
Right. So that's the question that USC doesn't really answer there. And USC has said that their admissions office really doesn't track this, doesn't track dollar figures, and it doesn't factor into admissions decisions. But these emails suggest that they're at least part of the consideration, right? It's one element of what the school is looking at when they're making decisions.
So this is probably not confined to USC. Other schools do this?
Correct. I think within higher ed, the general response to this story has kind of been, yes, of course. And I think major universities have enormous development offices, fundraising arms, and this is their job, is to figure out who might be able to give. And what good is it being a VIP somewhere if you don't get special treatment? So just how much of a potential quid pro quo there is might vary by school. Just what that dollar figure that could potentially get you special treatment varies by school. But the fact that this exists is something that's widely known. It's just quite shocking to see it in such blatant terms in email exchanges.
Well, right, because there is still this belief, however founded or unfounded it is, that a student should get in on his or her merits.
Absolutely, and this really does undermine or further undermine that assumption that that's how anything works here.
Right. So are people now saying, okay, we need to amend this or not? Or they're just saying this is the way we do it and so be it?
So in the wake of the scandal, a lot of schools have come out with new policies for how they verify applicants and the, athletic accolades or other claims on their applications. We really haven't seen much in the way of schools changing how they consider donations in the mix. I know that there is a proposal in the state of California that would require schools to disclose any special treatment for donors. That hasn't made its way through yet, and who knows if it will. But, I mean, there really isn't much incentive for schools to stop doing what they're already doing in terms of taking donations and, in some cases, rewarding those donors.
Right. But I think there's also the PR, the value of the bad PR, which is maybe incalculable at this point when a school is seen as doing
this. Yeah, and for some schools, right, absolutely. There's definitely the optics here. But again, as we said, this isn't new. This is something that schools have been doing that was new. They've been doing it forever. And schools have plenty of explanations for why they might give special consideration to certain applicants. So I have not yet seen any school say, no, we're not doing this anymore.
So there isn't any move in the wake of this scandal, this college admissions cheating scandal, the broader one, not just this particular wrinkle in it, to say, okay, we really need to amend the way we do business.
No, there really hasn't been. And that's something that I think is perhaps among the most shocking outcomes of all of this, is that a lot of schools are saying, no, we're fine. We're going to keep going as we were. I think the trial last fall, Harvard admissions trial last fall, laid a lot of this bare as well about the preferential treatment for athletes, for legacies, for students or for children of donors, family of donors. And, you know, it causes outrage in the moment and then schools go back to the way it was.
So is it now the case that if you have two applicants, one and they're pretty much equal or even not equal, I guess that's the more pertinent question, and the one who is not as qualified has a rich parent who's willing to make a donation, will that person be more likely to gain admission to one of these schools than the other one?
It depends on the donation amount. And I don't think we can say definitively, yes, they'll get in, but it's definitely something that the school looks at for most schools.
Melissa Corn is higher education reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, as Hurricane Dorian destroys the Bahamas, we check in with the Virgin Islands, which experienced two Category 5 hurricanes back-to-back 2 years ago. How has the recovery been since then? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Hurricane Dorian devastated the Bahamas. 7 people are dead. That number, though, will almost certainly rise. Here's CBS's Nora O'Donnell describing the scene.
Much of the islands now resemble a wasteland. Homes torn inside out, cars destroyed, trees stripped and toppled, residential streets now rushing rivers.
The ocean is literally here. It's all around us.
Major infrastructure has been rendered useless. The Grand Bahama Airport, for example, is underwater. And that's just one of the challenges rescuers face in the midst of such destruction.
It is going to be a very long road ahead for that Caribbean island nation. How do these nations recover from these kinds of disasters, these hurricanes? It has happened before, and we're going to ask Peter Bailey about that. He's from the Virgin Islands, and he's a journalist and a documentary filmmaker. He experienced Hurricanes Irma and Maria 2 years ago, and he made a documentary about that experience last year called Paradise Discovered, The Unbreakable Virgin Islanders. Peter, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Madeline? Thank you for having me.
So when you hear and you see the images on television about this Hurricane Dorian and the Bahamas, what does that call to mind for you?
It takes me right back to hell. Mm-hmm. And it takes me back right back to the middle of that hell, because Dorian actually became a hurricane on St. Thomas. It actually hit St. Thomas as a Category 1. And it came through and, you know, there are a lot of people there still have tarps on their roofs, like no roofs, you know, still have damage from those two hellish storms. It's a sense of hopelessness. It's a sense of hopelessness because in the Caribbean, let's be honest, Madeline, we're speaking right now because of a disaster. But in the, you know, the day-to-day, folks don't think about, when you close your eyes and think about the Caribbean, you don't see people. We don't exist. You see a vacation. You see, you know, sipping a mojito on the beach. So we've already
felt invisible. So imagine now the world has opened the gates of climatic hell, has descended on you. So you're hoping, will the world watch? Will the world help? You know, during Maria and Irma, we're the only place to ever be hit in history by two Category 5 storms in less than 2 weeks. And quite frankly, the rest of America never knew about it. You know, we were ignored. So I know the Bahamians, because we're all Caribbean, we might be separated by water, but we're one people that's connected on a common thread of culture, a culture that's very isolated. I think the Bahamas, like the Virgin Islands, is at a crossroads, and that crossroads means reinvention. You know, where do you stand in the larger dialogue of global politics when climate change is an issue that, hell, our own, the most powerful nation on the planet, ignores? So I can't imagine what they're going through, because after those storms, when we went outside, it had looked like a bomb went off. Like, literally, it was like the apocalypse. It's like, it was worse than I kind of can imagine in those films you see. You know, like, what was that from the Book of Eli? Mm-hmm. Where it's just this, it's just wasteland. I mean, the tree, it's all brown outside, right? So the flies are feeding these dead animals. It's hell. That's all I can expect. It's hell. But I would say with the Bahamians, what we had to do as a people is accept, look, if help doesn't come, we have to really revert back to that sense of community. So, this is when you really understand what community means.
Yeah. And so talk about that aid and what came or what didn't come for your community at 2 years ago or after, yeah, in the aftermath 2 years ago.
Well, I mean, the president said that he met with the president of the Virgin Islands.
Yeah.
So that tells you just how much he demanded even know that we were part of America. And then he decided to meet our governor on a ship in the ocean. He never set foot on the Virgin Islands soil. Right after the storms, so our airport is destroyed, right? So basically, goods and stuff usually have to go to Puerto Rico first to come to us. So Puerto Rico was devastated. We have no airports. Nothing can come in and come out. I remember distinctly one of our neighbors had a case of Chef Boyardee. And our block, like my house and the other blocks, we were surviving on that for like 2 weeks. I remember being on top because we lost the roof, and I had written that in New York Times, our pet has America forgotten the Virgin Islands, while building that roof. I remember my mother, she's 76, and she's saying, you think Trump is going to come? And when he didn't come, and then we finally got internet, and we're seeing the news in America, and we didn't exist. So it's that sense of isolation that really creeps in. But quite frankly, Madeline, the larger American public, media, politics, they dropped the ball when coming to the U.S. Virgin Islands. And Dorian just hit, and we still were ignored.
Yeah. tell me in the 2 years, you know, people talk about recovery and getting back to normal, yeah, and returning back to bringing in the tourists and all that.
Yes.
Has that happened in the Virgin Islands?
Our hotels are just opening. So, yes, we're telling people we are open for business. So, yes, we are ready for tourists to start coming back. But as you can imagine, it raises the specter of, okay, are we going to diverse our economy in the Virgin Islands, in Puerto Rico, in the Bahamas? Because when these storms hit, if what, 85% of your economy is based on visitors and tourists, and a natural disaster occurs, where else are you going to get your income, right? So I think the Bahamian officials have to now consider the reinvention of their economy. You know, they have to. I mean, they really have to. A lot of your businesses, we're really focused on trying to get entrepreneurs' investments, because with FEMA, a lot of people in the Virgin Islands did not get help. For whatever reason, they were denied. So they're struggling. People are still struggling these islands. So when I look at the Bahamas, you know, we like to get on these shows. I guess I'm not a politically correct guy. The truth is, those folks are in the middle of hell. And what are the answers in an unprecedented catastrophe like this one and what happened in the Virgin Islands? All we can say is, let's hope the larger world starts looking at us in this region as human beings and not just people to serve at their pleasure, yeah, basically.
So this idea of reinventing the economy, if 85% of the economy, yes, is based on tourism, and basically, after a devastating Category 5 or 2, in your case, hurricane hits.
Yeah.
It's basically, let's just try to survive, right? I mean, no one's thinking,
yes,
about a bigger bigger mission of changing the direction of your economy.
No, you can't. So right now, when we look at the Bahamas and these discussions, there's no discussion to be had beyond there's a guy waking up right now that just lost his entire house. He probably doesn't know where his family members are, and he's outside in hell. So right now, it's a gut check. Right now, the people of the Bahamas have to search their souls. Because I think, I remember when we survived, I came outside and I said, how are we going to come back from this? And some people, quite frankly, will never come back. You know, I think we like the hero tales and we like to say what sounds good, but quite frankly, man, some people will never come back from this. They won't. Some people, if you lose everything, 20 years, you built a house, you saved money, now that's gone. Now, whatever little money you have to spend surviving, right? You literally have to start over. You can't go back and say, let's pick up these pieces because those pieces are gone. So you have to start completely over. And then after the fact, you deal with the specter, the idea that people now are coming in. Like after Katrina, where, okay, properties are cheap. The place is devastated. Developers are now going to swoop in. And then you face, will my community still remain the face of it? Will it remain? And quite frankly, maybe or maybe not. Hmm. So that's what the Bahamians are facing right now.
Is that what happened in St. Thomas?
That's what's happening right now. We have, after these storms, people are vultures. They come in. You're on your knees. So if you need money, okay, hell, I'll give you my house for X amount of dollars. So that's what we're facing.
And then I guess you have people thinking that they can make some money off tourism.
Of course. It's disaster capitalism. You face the nonprofits that are, some of them are bogus. You face these politicians who travel the world, never thought we exist, and all of a sudden they're there saying they're going to help. But who's really going to benefit? The people? So the core lesson and value learned from this is we have to be our own heroes. And I think in the Caribbean, we've been accustomed to being ignored. So we hope help comes, but at the end of the day, it's on us. That's just our narrative. It's on us, basically.
Well, Peter Bailey, I want to thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Yes, ma'am. You too.
That's Peter Bailey. He is a filmmaker and director of a documentary called Paradise Discovered, The Unbreakable Virgin Islanders. Okay, we are in day two of our KCRW UnDrive, which is not really a standard pledge drive, but it is our key way of raising money. We have two fundraisers a year. This is our fall fundraiser, and we're doing something different from all other public radio stations, and that is we are not interrupting programming, none of the news, none of the music, none of the cultural shows that you know and love and rely on to beg you for money, but we are asking you to just do your part. Quietly and effectively, 800-600-5279 or kcrw.com/join. Lots of great thank you gifts there. And I want to thank you for becoming a KCRW donor. Coming up, abalone are endangered off our California coast. They are disappearing fast. We're going to talk about that with my favorite marine biologist, Pat Krug. Plus, Susan Strait, the author of a new memoir, In the Country of Women, a history of the women in her family, including her no-nonsense Swiss mom.
And my mother said no. She didn't want to pay for the uniform, and she said cheerleaders were stupid and brainless, and they were only going to get married, and that wasn't what was going to happen for me because I was already too unattractive.
Well, how she found love and created a beautiful family, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Abalone is disappearing fast off the coast of California. Abalone is a kind of sea slug. It's about the size of a dinner plate, and it had been a popular menu item here in California. Its numbers, though, are cratering despite a decades-old ban on commercial fishing of red abalone. Now even recreational fishing is banned until at least 2021, maybe indefinitely. Marine biologist Pat Krug is here to talk about the abalone. Hi.
Madeline, it is so good to be back.
It is so good to have you, although you are the bearer of bad tidings, and that is...
I mean, I'm thrilled to be here to talk about abalone because they're one of my favorite animals, but man, are they having a hard time.
Okay, so but they've been having a hard time for a while.
They've been having a hard time for a very long time, and it's our fault. We have literally eaten these animals into near extinction, and the environment just keeps getting worse and worse for them.
And that is the reason why they're disappearing, just because we eat them?
I mean, it's a perfect storm of bad effects, and we're a big part of that. If you go back historically, you can find photographs from the Channel Islands, say from 75, 80 years ago, where there were abalone the size of dinner plates stacked 5 to 10 deep on every rock. Imagine a coastline of California where there were that many abalone everywhere you looked. Wow. We used to have a commercial fishery for red abalone, pink abalone, that was taking 2,000 tons a year from our coastline. And that was just part of the California coast. I mean, these animals were that abundant.
Amazing. But then commercial fishing was banned like in the 90s, right?
So in 1997, the stocks of a number of species had crashed. We have about 6 major species on this coast. They're color-coded for your convenience. So there's red, green, white, black, pink, pinto. And we fished a bunch of those different species to the point where commercial harvests had stopped being sustainable. So in 97, the state banned all commercial harvest, all harvest period south of San Francisco. And north of San Francisco, there was a recreational fishery, but only what you could free dive to. So no scuba diving was allowed for abalone harvest.
And now that's banned.
Yeah. I mean, that recreational fishery was still huge. In the 80s, people were removing, you know, 3 million pounds of abalone in 1 year recreationally. So this was
massive. Just from free diving?
Yeah. It was a massive fishery. You know, and the estimated value is in the, you know, $40, $50 million a year to the state. So it's a valuable fishery. People love abalone, but they're in steady decline. So their numbers have not recovered despite a more than 20-year ban from harvest in most of the state.
So what's accounting for that? Because it's not us eating them.
I mean, it's a little bit of everything. So part of the problem is we took so many abalone out that their numbers were not naturally recovering. In the 80s, there was a disease, the withering syndrome, this bacterial infection that hammered a lot of the populations that were left. And then in the 90s, we really started to see the catastrophic effects of ocean warming. So as the oceans have continued to get warmer and warmer for the last 2 decades, that's been really hitting our kelp forests hard. If you look at maps, you can see over the last 10, 15 years, our kelp forests have shrunk so dramatically in size. And kelp feeds abalone and some of their competitors like purple urchins. And so now these organisms that have coexisted for a very long time are competing for a dwindling resource. And when urchins get hungry, they go on the prowl, they head out, and they start stripping all the available kelp that's left off the rocky reefs, and there's very little food for abalone.
We've talked about these perps before.
We have.
They're pretty aggressive.
Because you remember perps.
I do.
Yeah. It's fun to say.
It is. And they have the spiny shells, so that makes them hard for predators to eat, right? But abalone, they're just sitting out there naked.
So abalone have a pretty tough shell that material scientists study to even understand how thick and tough it can be. They can withstand waves, so they can live in places where it's hard for other organisms to live. But their defense is primarily to just hunker down. So they are shy by nature. They hide under rocks and under ledges, and they generally wait for kelp to come to them. They don't tend to mobilize the way urchins do. But you can see pictures now in Northern California of abalone that are so hungry, they're out there like crawling up the stems of kelp looking for food, which is like, you know, almost a suicidal move for an abalone. It's going to get eaten, but they're that hungry because there's so little kelp out there. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, a consequence of ocean warming, that kelp thrive in cold, nutrient-rich waters. And with the blob, this superheated ocean formation that formed in 2014 to 2016, we've had unusually warm water on top of a warming ocean, and our kelp hasn't recovered. Now the urchins are eating what kelp is out there in Northern California, and red abalone have declined to the point where there's no recreational take left, at least for 2 more
years.
Do you
think they'll go extinct off our coast?
So tragically, the black abalone and the white abalone were the first two marine invertebrates that were federally listed as endangered species, which is a dubious distinction. I'm afraid that more abalone may join them as endangered species. The red has a much broader range, so that may help protect it, but there's not a lot of hope in sight, and it's distressing that our hunger for these animals has put them in such a precarious place that now global warming and competition from other species may threaten their survival.
Well, Pat, thank you for coming in.
Hopefully better news next time.
I hope so. Patrick Krug, marine biologist at Cal State LA.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, appreciating Riverside, California. Writer Susan Strait is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Author Susan Strait grew up in Riverside. It's where she met her future husband. It's where she raised her 3 daughters. It's where she works as a professor of creative writing at UC Riverside. Now that she's an empty nester, she's written a book, a memoir, really, to remind her daughters where they came from. It's a book about 6 generations of women who came before them. On one side, from the Alps in Switzerland. On the other, from a slave cabin in the South. The book is called In the Country of Women. Welcome to the show, Susan Strait. It's great to have you. Great to see you again.
I'm glad to see you again. So happy.
I'm so happy, and I was so happy to read your book. In the Country of Women is basically in the country of women in your family. So on the one side, you have your mother and her grandmother and your stepmother and her mother and all of those women. On the other side, you have your ex-husband's mother and ancestors from totally different parts of the world, right? And yet you all get together in Riverside, this kind of an unlikely place, right?
It's a very California story,
for this melting pot.
People don't often think of Riverside. I think people think of San Francisco and Los Angeles and other places as the typical California story of melting pot. But growing up on my street, on the block, there were people whose moms were Japanese or German or Korean and their dads were African American, or moms who were Mexican and their dads were like Irish guys that were in the army. Everyone got along. Everyone played basketball and we all traded food. We had a great childhood.
You had a great childhood, even though you recount some really horrific incidents in your childhood, one of which involved your mother running you over.
She says it was an accident.
Station wagon.
When we used to tease her about it, she'd say, well, if I really wanted to kill you, I would run over your head, not your leg. And we were like, that doesn't make it feel better.
but yeah. You were really laid up for a long time in traction. Does it still bother you, your leg?
It was a crazy story. The reason that I got run over is because I wanted to be a cheerleader. And I was already this really skinny, unattractive, poor kid with terrible clothing. And I had awful blue cat eye glasses, which now are fun in an ironic way, but there was no irony back then,
no.
not in sixth grade. And I was determined going into junior high to be a cheerleader, and I was practicing with my friends, and my mother said no. She didn't want to pay for the uniform, and she said cheerleaders were stupid and brainless, and they were only going to get married, and that wasn't what was going to happen for me because I was already too unattractive. So then we went camping, and she accidentally backed the Ford Country Squire station wagon over me because I insisted on going back down the mountain from where we were camping in the mountains. I wanted to go to cheerleader camp. So there was no cheerleader camp, and it did take me 6 months to learn to walk again.
But your mother also told you, you say, she said you were ugly. It was the ugly talk that you remember quite clearly back then.
I completely understand the ugly talk now, because where I grew up, a lot of my girlfriends already had started not just using drugs. You know, we were 13 or 14, and, you know, we lived in some pretty serious times where we were. There was a lot of drugs, not just marijuana, but methamphetamine.
So this is like late 70s, early 80s.
It was the late 70s and early 80s, and it was really dangerous. And I think my mother saw what was happening to a lot, not just of the boys around me, but the girls. I think she gave me the ugly talk to protect me, and she didn't know any other way to do it. My three daughters are all really smart, but they're all very beautiful. So I used to tease them when they would hang out with my mom. I'd say, it's going to be pretty hard to give them the ugly talk, isn't it, Mom? And my mom would look at them and say, well, because they're beautiful. You aren't.
Wow.
She never wavers, my mom.
So she said, with your looks, you'll probably never get married. The only thing you have going for you is your brain. So you'd better not mess it up with drugs.
Yeah, she did. And so she was right. I didn't look very good. I also had, you know, aside from the one leg is straight, the one that was run over, and the other leg is bowed, so my legs don't even match. My children are fond of seeing
just
that now.
FYI, listener, because you can't see Susan right now, but I can. She does not deserve the ugly talk at all.
Oh, well. I still have glasses. I have a gap between my teeth.
So that's your mom's side. That's your side. The other woman that figures quite prominently in your book and in your life, obviously, is your ex-husband's mother.
Right. I wrote the book really from my mother-in-law, Alberta. I wrote the book because my mother-in-law took my hand when I was 16 and not just was kind to me, but invited me into her kitchen and told me stories and always taught me to cook for the stranger.
Oh, that's lovely. Talk about that moment, because here you are in high school dating the man who would be, well, the boy, I guess, who would be your future husband, because you're both teenagers, Dwayne. And he's a tall black basketball player.
You're very short.
You're short, white,
not cheerleader.
Non-cheerleader with a formerly broken leg.
Right.
There's like a foot in height difference between the two of you, right?
Yeah. My mom loved Dwayne because he was tall and he was an athlete. And those are two things that are very important to her, because she's 4'11" and I'm 5'4". So we went to his driveway and there were more than 100 people. And just imagine, I'm a short, blonde, white girl wearing a halter dress from the swap meet and borrowed platform shoes. And until I started writing this, you know, I've thought about this moment many times throughout my life, but all of the men in that driveway had terrible stories of things that had happened, whether riots in Tulsa or, you know, Ku Klux Klan visits in Louisiana that were precipitated by a small white woman or a white woman who had claimed that something had happened untoward. And I'm walking up that driveway and all the men are nothing but kind to me, because they say, oh, Dwayne's been talking about you. And then I open, you know, I go into the kitchen and my mother-in-law opens the door to the house and says, here she is. He finally brought her over and she takes me right into the kitchen and she said, let's make you a plate. And she started talking to me about cooking and how she always cooks for the stranger. And that turned into, over the course of all the years I knew her, the stories about why she was so generous, because her mother had been orphaned at the age of 5 and had never had anything to her name until she arrived in Riverside with 4 daughters by herself. And so my mother-in-law was the one who taught me to think about, you're not just raising your own children, you're raising the whole neighborhood. And that's the way I still operate today.
Mm. That is very, very powerful. You must have been pretty intimidated walking into that gathering.
I was just sad about my very, very tragic clothes. And I was sad because I didn't know if anybody would like me. You know, I was the first white person that had come down that driveway.
Yeah, the driveway figures a lot in your social life, in the community life in Riverside. A lot of activity happens in the driveway, whether it's at your house or at your mother-in-law's house. Why the driveway?
It's such a Southern California thing that people don't recognize it, because, you know, I was just in Brooklyn for a book event, and I love walking in Brooklyn and thinking about a tree grows in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. The stoop is in Brooklyn. You have your parties on the stoop and you talk on the stoop. And for us, you know, in my neighborhood, but also everywhere I go, you'll have a driveway and you have 3 easy ups and you have a party. You know, so my neighbor, next door neighbor, Mario.
Easy ups are those canopy things.
Yeah. So you don't party in the driveway. So my next door neighbor, Mario.
A very small driveway.
He was partying in the driveway last week and my daughter was visiting. And so he had carne asada. He had 2 kinds of chorizo. And I think it's such a classically Southern California thing, because in the wintertime, we have a fire in the trash barrel and we have the Lakers on. The TV's outside. And in the summertime, it's really hot. So, you know, the TV's also outside, but we've got the cooler and it's
the Dodgers.
You got the Dodgers. And to me, the driveway is where people like us live our lives. You know, you live outside because it's hot and you didn't always have air conditioning. But there's also, that means you're open to the whole community. So anyone can stop by because you're in the driveway. And if someone stops by and says, hey, you know, you guys having a fish fry? They might have a certain yearning in their voice and we can tell they're hungry. And we're like, yeah, there's fish. You know, have a seat. And when I think about what that has meant for all these years, you know, more than 40 years in Riverside on Michael Street, it means that I ran into the mail person, the letter carrier, and she told me, I've been carrying mail on Michael Street and I never miss a lunch. Like, everyone always has given me a hot link or, you know, a hot dog or a hamburger. That's really something.
That is. And Riverside is so important to you. You write that you never really left it. I mean, you went to graduate school in Amherst and where you were lucky enough to be mentored by James Baldwin.
Yes.
And he said to you, I want to get the quote exact, you must continue to write. It is imperative.
He was really helpful. We were afraid of Amherst, though. Mm-hmm. We weren't treated well in Amherst, yeah, except for by James Baldwin and some of my friends.
You described some really shocking cases of racism by, yeah, other professors.
Some really bad things happened to us. I mean, James Baldwin would always, after workshop, he would take the whole class out to a bar on the main street in Amherst. And I had never been to that bar. And Duane, at that point, worked graveyard shift for a correctional institution. So one day I made it a big deal and I said, let's go and you can come have a drink with my workshop class. And they wouldn't let us in. They said California driver's licenses weren't valid. And it was the bouncer looking at Duane and me. So the reason I bring it up is because we did come right home. We were mm-hmm. cold too. Mm-hmm. We were cold and we had wrecked
really
the car.
Left, right?
No, we After came that? Home. You know, I didn't even stay for graduation. We just came home and because we had a safety net here. And Duane started working as a correctional officer. And I got my first teaching job when I was 23 at Inland Empire Job Corps in San Bernardino, and we have never left.
So you and your husband divorced because you, what, married too young and he wanted to, you don't know, he just decided, I mean, he wanted to.
We had been married young and then there were all these kids and it was hard and lots of, you know, if I was 34 when we got divorced and I was 15 when we got together, people tease me and I say, but if you get married when you're 40 and you're married for
that's 20 years, yeah,
like we already had our 20 years. And
but
they say,
you're still friends.
Yeah. And we still hang out pretty much all the time, which is fine. I mean, we have kids together, but also it's lovely to still have all of my cousins and all my sisters-in-law and all my nieces and nephews and that to be family.
So you are surrounded by the Sims, mm-hmm. by Sims.
But I still see my mom and every, you know, week, and I talk to her every other day. She lives 3 miles from me.
So your mom's still there?
Yeah, and my stepdad, and I still have aunts and uncles as well, but they don't live in Riverside. So I've always been grateful to have a really large marriage family that has sustained me forever, because my other family was much more fractured and people went away and never came back.
And your daughters are all, as you say, scattered. They don't live there. And do you think they might come back to live in Riverside?
That's a good question.
One day?
Because
you want them to, I assume.
My oldest daughter lives in Austin, Texas, and loves it there and is in a PhD program at University of Texas, Austin. She's a historian. My middle daughter, Delphine, is in Oakland. She goes to Berkeley. She's also a PhD student, and she specializes in art history, images of Black women in photography. And my youngest daughter, Rosette, lives here in West Hollywood.
And so you end the book by saying, really, at the end of it all, there's not much to pass on except for memories. And is that the reason why you wrote this book, for them to have this encapsulated?
It
their
is.
The history,
yeah,
of them, of you, of the women in your family.
I think something that we should talk about more, and that I like talking about this, is that our stories as women are often the stories that we tell each other. And my mother-in-law and all of our family would sit there and I would hear amazing stories about how Aunt Jenny shot a man between the eyes after he attacked her. and she was maybe 17.
A white man.
A white man. And Aunt Jenny always had a gun. And the story of Aunt Jenny is then an oral story. That's the kind of story that, if I'm the first person to write it down, I can only feel honored that it exists now in the world. And there are images in the book, too. There are 24 photos in the book of Fine or of Aunt Jenny or of my real grandmother, Frida, who died when my mom was only 9 and has this beautiful Swiss costume from the mountain, the Alps of Switzerland. I never met my grandmother, but there's her picture. It makes me very happy to see it. And it makes me really happy to see my mother-in-law, Alberta, because she died when I was pregnant with Rosette. And Rosette looks like her. She has a dimple in the same place. And I always think to have this picture now all over the world means that our women's stories are enshrined forever on a piece of paper, but they also continue being told in the world.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing some, just a little bit of the stories of your family.
It was really nice to see you again.
Susan Strait, author of the new memoir, In the Country of Women. All right. Well, that does it for us today on Press Play. But before I get out of here, I just want to ask you guys to renew your membership or become a new member, kcrw.com/join. We're in our UnDrive fund drive, so we don't break into any programming. We just ask you during our regularly scheduled breaks to do your part to support what you hear on public radio. Beautiful conversations, in-depth news, no bias. We're here for you, so be here for us. kcrw.com/join. I'll see you tomorrow.